Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, present The Dragon Stone by Nick Hawkes, narrated by Grant Cartwright. Chapter 1. The dragon head was 62 years old and looked every bit his age. Although this man was his father, Kai never related to him as such. He wouldn't dare. No one related to a dragon head with anything other than formality. Operationally, his father held the rank of First Route Marshal in the 14K Triad Society. The symbol of that rank was a dragon's head. Of course, most people didn't know that and simply referred to him as Mr. K, but those who knew him even slightly were careful to show respect. Kai stopped 6 paces from his father's desk, bowed, and waited. The window shutters were closed, and the room was dark. It was always dark. A pungent, spicy smell filled the air. Joss sticks were burning in the household shrine, recessed into the wall. It was lit by a dull red light. His father looked at him, saying nothing. It was an old game, one designed to put Kai in his place. Wooden screens stood to the right of his father's mahogany desk. 2 armed guards would be behind them, watching through the fretwork. Kai wondered which guards would be on duty today. Probably Ah Feng and Ah Kung. Ah Feng would have a shotgun. Ah Kung didn't need one. His father spoke in Cantonese.
I am displeased.
Kai lowered his head. It was the right way to signal mortification.
I am sorry, sir.
The dragon head slapped the desk.
Do not interrupt.
His father's blackened teeth snapped shut. 10 years of smoking opium had rotted them. He'd quit the habit many years ago through sheer willpower, but he'd never had his teeth seen to. He hated dentists. Kai stood stiffly to attention. The old man pointed to him.
You are Goko, a 438, and more is expected of you. Money from your section has plateaued. You have not grown business for 9 months. Why is that?
Kai kept his silence. He was in charge of Huk Nam, the City of Darkness, and was therefore responsible for the income it generated for the 14K.
Are other societies taking our business?
His father's querulous voice whipped at him again.
No, sir. Our enemy, the Sun Yi On, have given up trying to infiltrate, at least for now. What about the Jing Yi?
We have had a Gong Su, a peace talk with the Jing Yi. It is now agreed where their boundary in the city ends. We can work alongside them.
His father slapped the desktop again.
See that the boundary is policed. I don't want any other triad society encroaching on our territory.
Kai nodded.
The real problem is that the City of Darkness is filled to capacity. The Building Ordnance Office are enforcing the only building code they insist on, that no building can be more than 17 stories high.
Kai shrugged.
The wheels of the planes flying into Kai Tak Airport nearly touch them as it is.
Is that an excuse?
No, sir. That is reality. Only so many drug dens and brothels fit on 6 acres of land.
The old man sneered.
There is always room for more, particularly among the squatters along the edge of the city.
Kai wondered whether the gods in the household shrine were listening to their conversation and what they were thinking. He glanced at the shrine on the wall. Food offerings had been placed next to the joss sticks to placate the spirits of his ancestors and to ensure good luck. Kai approved. It was important to venerate the household gods, as they had more influence on the day-to-day affairs of life than the big gods. Any favours that could be cajoled from the big gods of Taoism, Confucianism, and Buddhism were simply a bonus.
Pay attention,
his father snapped.
Where does your mind go?
I was thinking about our gods, sir.
His father grunted and leaned back in his chair. Nothing was said for a while, but the silence was relative. Kai could hear a cacophony of street noises coming from Nathan Road just outside. It was one of the busiest streets in Kowloon. His father broke the silence.
I thought I would have to pay a drug addict for his son, so he could become my son and pray for my spirit when I'm dead. But then you were born.
He sniffed.
Just be sure to fulfill your duty.
Yes, sir.
His father looked at him balefully and pointed a finger.
I want you to diversify into high-end extortion and kidnapping. This is 1972, and there is more money in Hong Kong and more rich people now than there has ever been. They need to know of our reputation and fear us to such an extent that even a phone call with a threat will cause them to pay.
Kai wondered idly what the gods of the rich people would think about that. His father shouted,
Do you understand?
Yes, sir.
You must show an iron fist.
His father jabbed a finger at him again.
You particularly must work hard at this, because you look like an American. That makes it harder for Chinese people to respect you.
Kai knew he didn't have an ounce of American blood in him, but he didn't press the point. Kai could just see enough through the window slats to make out the top of a red and white double-decker bus, burrowing its way along Nathan Road. Everyone seemed to be going somewhere. Kai, on the other hand, had no idea where he was going.
You may go,
barked his father, waving him away as if he were a bothersome insect. Kai bowed and left. He collected his own two bodyguards from the foyer and headed outside into the maze of narrow streets, shopping stalls, bars and nightlife that made up the district of Mong Kok. The 14K were active in this area, particularly in the brothels. However, he was not responsible for this region. As such, he did not know which areas were in dispute between the competing triad societies. He was away from his own area and was therefore vulnerable. The Sun Yi On often waited for occasions such as this to spring an ambush. Kai grimaced. The curse of it was that he, with his European features, was easily recognizable. He glanced up at the ugly high-rises surrounding him. They had caged steel balconies perched on their side. Bamboo poles holding people's washing poked out from them. However, at the base of these buildings was another world. Market stalls spilled out from under untidy awnings along the laneways. Stalls with boxes of vegetables cluttered the alleys, barely leaving enough room for pedestrians to walk. It was a sea of color. Scrappy billboards and posters were stuck on almost every vertical surface. Some of these were advertising Bruce Lee's latest film, Fist of Fury. The film star was very popular. Every triad fighter aspired to be like him. The business of Mong Kok was in full swing all around them. There was the hiss of cooking from the noodle stalls, steaming woks, and the clack of tiles being turned by the mahjong players sitting at tables. The devil beaters were also busy. If you paid them money, they would use a shoe to whack an image of your enemy drawn on a piece of paper. That enemy could either be a person or an evil spirit. Kai understood this to be serious business. Good fortune, particularly as it pertained to money and good health, was everyone's obsession in Hong Kong. Rich and poor alike consulted mediums and fortune tellers when they needed to make a decision. They passed an alley leading to a brothel he knew was controlled by 14K. Squatting on the ground near its entrance was a small boy. Kai recognized that he must be the Tin Man Toy, the weatherman. His job was to report on those who entered the alleyway, either to bring danger or business. What attracted Kai's attention was the boy's pitiful state. He was emaciated and filthy, barely an animated skeleton. Kai stopped beside him and nudged him with his foot. The young boy looked up in terror. It was a look that stayed on his face when he noticed the signal Kai was making with his hand. The urchin now knew that Kai was part of his own society, 14K. Kai spoke curtly.
What's your name?
Sai Di, the boy mumbled.
You are Sai Lo, a little brother.
Yes.
Who is your Dai Lo, your big brother? The one who is meant to be looking after you.
The boy pointed across the laneway to a group of three young men who were eating at a noodle stall. Kai turned and stepped across to the three young men. The men immediately got to their feet and braced themselves for a fight. Fear was plainly written on their faces. Kai could understand it. He was large by Chinese standards, and his two bodyguards, Ah Tsui and Ah Ming, were just as big. Eventually their gaze fell on the hand signal Kai had made, and they relaxed slightly.
"Who is Big Brother to Sai Di?"
Kai demanded, pointing to the urchin across the laneway.
"I am," replied one of the men.
Kai noticed that the man who spoke was well-built and had plenty of flesh. Anger began to boil up within him.
"Do you know what your duty is as a Dai Lo, as a Big Brother?"
The man said nothing. Kai waved a hand at Ah Ming, one of his bodyguards.
"Ah Ming is a red pole. Do you know what that means?"
The eyes of the man in front of him widened, and then he nodded. It meant that Ah Ming was responsible for organizing the strategy and weapons needed to carry out 14K's fights and ambushes. He was a fighter. Kai turned to his bodyguard.
"Ah Ming, tell him what it means to be a Dai Lo."
The man cowered back as Ah Ming stepped forward. Without a word, the bodyguard took Kai's right forearm and lifted it for everyone to see. The ugly scar that crossed the top of Kai's forearm was clearly visible. Ah Ming said in a low voice,
"I am Sai Lo to Mr. Kai. He is Goko, my big brother. One night, I was ambushed by 5 Sun Yi-on. They had meat cleavers and steel pipes. I would have died if Mr. Kai hadn't come to my aid."
Ah Ming glared at the man.
"We were outnumbered, and he was badly wounded in the fight, but we drove them off."
He let go of Kai's arm.
"That's what it means to be a Dai Lo."
The man in front of him dropped his head. Kai barked,
"Look at me!"
The man jerked his head up.
"You are duty-bound to share what you have with your Sai Lo. That is basic to our code. Do you understand?"
The man nodded. Nothing was said for a while. Kai allowed the silence. Then he picked up the man's noodle bowl and took it across the laneway to the boy.
"Eat it," he commanded.
The boy did not move.
"Go on,"
Kai urged. Tentatively, the boy reached out, took the bowl, and began to eat. At first, hesitantly, and then with feverish haste. When he'd finished, Kai took the bowl back to the noodle stall and banged it down on the table. The men jumped back in alarm. Kai pointed to his other bodyguard.
"This man is Ah Tsui. He is also a red pole."
He glared at the men.
"We will be watching you."
Chapter 2. The pike rose slowly to the surface of the water and stayed there, as if wanting to be seen. Emma held her breath. It was at least 2 feet long. A pike, the hunter, the dominant predator of the River Cherwell. In all the years Emma had been at Oxford, she'd never seen one until now. Its olive-brown back moved languidly, keeping it on station against the flow of the current. Emma lifted her gaze and glanced across the river. The Cherwell was flowing peacefully between the beech trees edging Christchurch Meadow Walk. No one else was on the footpath to share the sight. When she looked back, the pike was gone. She shivered. Evidently, today was going to be a day of firsts, and she was not sure she was ready for any of them. Emma glanced at her watch for the umpteenth time, willing time to stop, wanting to retreat to the safety of the past. The second hand of the watch ticked on remorselessly. It was time to go. Taking a deep breath, Emma made her way back to St. Hilda's College and her interview with Professor Harrington. 45 minutes later, her worst fears were realized. Professor Harrington sat in front of her, beaming.
"You've passed, Emma. Your PhD has been accepted. They don't even want an edit, let alone a rewrite."
He leaned forward to shake her hand.
"I must say, you've done extraordinarily well."
She shook his hand mechanically, then leaned her elbows on the professor's desk and put her head in her hands.
"No, no, no."
The professor, all solicitors, walked around the desk and laid a hand on her shoulder.
"I know it's a bit much to take in, Emma, but you've finally finished."
He paused before adding,
"It must be rather a lot to take in right now.
Showing emotion is quite understandable. But you don't understand.
Her stomach churned and twisted. The professor continued on, blithely.
How long have you been a student with us in Oxford?
Emma swallowed and spoke between her fingers.
7 years. 3 for my bachelor's degree and 4 for the doctorate. That's a long time in anyone's life.
He gave her shoulder a squeeze.
Now off you go and celebrate.
She suppressed a sob, stumbled to her feet and found the door. Professor Harrington called after her.
Oh, Emma, I nearly forgot. Someone wants to meet with you. He's in town on business and staying at the Randolph Hotel. Evidently, he wants to talk with you about doing some postdoctoral work in the socio-political changes taking place in China. It's very much your area of expertise.
The professor picked up a folded piece of paper from the desk and held it out to her.
He's hoping you might be able to meet him at 5 p.m. today at the Randolph. Is that possible?
Emma took the piece of paper, nodded dumbly, and stumbled out the door. A minute later, she was leaning on one of the pillars supporting the two archways of St. Hilda's entrance porch. She held a fist against her stomach, bent over, and felt sick. After 7 years, it was over. She would have to leave Oxford, the safe womb that had held her and protected her against the indifference of her parents. What on earth would she do now? She glanced up at the brick and stone grandeur of South Building, with its crenellated bay windows and views across the river to the spires of Oxford. St. Hilda's was one of only 2 Oxford colleges that admitted women, and it was the nearest thing she'd ever had to a home. Moves were afoot to have women admitted to some of the men's colleges, but she suspected that change was still a few years off. Even though it was 1972, and the country was heaving with social revolution, nothing moved quickly at Oxford. It was one of the reasons she loved it. Its colleges gave her a sense of history and safety.
"Get a grip on yourself, girl," she sniffed,
then began searching for a handkerchief, an act that reminded her that she was holding the piece of paper given to her by the professor. Emma unfolded it and scanned the contents. There wasn't much to read. It was a short note scribbled on some stationery paper from the Randolph Hotel. "Dear Miss Templeton, my name is John Egerton. I work for a department answerable to the Home Secretary. I would like the opportunity to talk with you about your thesis and perhaps explore the possibility of some postdoctoral work. I am in town at the Randolph until tomorrow. Can we meet at the Acanthus Restaurant at 5 p.m.? John Egerton." Emma glanced at her watch. It was 4 o'clock already. If she were going to meet with John Egerton, she would have to get moving straight away. Was she dressed smartly enough? Probably not. She was wearing jeans, a white shirt, and a waisted jacket. It would have to do. As she walked up Cowley Place to the High Street, Emma gave herself a stern talking to. The result of this was that she resolved to at least try to celebrate her achievement. She'd phone some of her girlfriends from the OICCU and invite them round to her place tonight for some wine and nibbles. It wouldn't be much, but it was all she had the emotional energy for. She was pretty confident the girls would cheer her up. They generally did. The team at the Intercollegiate Christian Union had become her family, the family she'd never had. They'd been generous in their love, and over the years had given meaning and hope to a shy introvert, desperately trying to please the world. Emma turned into High Street and walked over Magdalen Bridge. She paused to watch people poling their punts along the river beside the water meadows. It was an idyllic May day. Her route into town was one she'd walked hundreds of times, but today she looked at the features along High Street as if for the first time. There was the austere face of Magdalen College, the extravagant Baroque arches of Queen's College and University College that claimed links to King Alfred. A little further on was St. Mary's Church, the place where Bishops Latimer and Ridley were tried for heresy. They were found guilty and burned at the stake because of their desire to return the church to a more biblical foundation. Emma looked at the soaring spire and wondered for the umpteenth time how such a beautiful place could be used for such evil. But then again, nothing good ever seemed to come from institutionalizing the church. Eventually, she came to Sainsbury's on the corner of Corn Market Street. She loved this store. It had decorative tiles on the wall, beautiful mosaic floors, long marble counters, and men in aprons waiting to serve you. She bought some Stilton cheese and liver pate, paying for them with the new decimal currency that Britain had so recently adopted. She liked the new currency. It was tidier. Emma loved tidiness and order. They helped her feel safe. The Randolph Hotel was just a little way up the road, opposite the Ashmolean Museum. It was a grand Victorian affair, built in the Gothic style, presumably to make it fit in with the character of the ancient colleges that surrounded it. She paused in the front entrance to gather herself together, then walked inside. The entrance foyer featured a marble staircase with an intricate iron-wrought balustrade that curled round the reception desk. The young man behind the desk pointed the way to the Acanthus restaurant. It was a room filled with gilded portraits and mirrors. High above, heraldic crests of the different Oxford colleges decorated the eaves. It was not yet dinner time, so she was not surprised to be the only one there. She took the opportunity to inspect herself in one of the mirrors. A depressingly ordinary-looking girl stared back at her. Her face was pretty enough, but she had brown hair. Brown! So ordinary! It was currently pulled back into a loose bun. She reflected ruefully that so much about her was average. Average height, average figure. There was nothing about her that was special. Emma chose a table near the door and began straightening the napkins as she waited. In the event, she did not have long to wait. A slim man with a pencil mustache entered the room and walked toward her. Although middle-aged, his hair was jet black and brushed backward over his scalp. He was dressed in a grey suit and was in every way unremarkable. The only arresting feature about him was his eyes. They had an intensity about them that warned her not to underestimate him. "Emma Templeton, I presume?" "Yes." "Ah, good. I'm John Egerton." She stood up and shook his hand. It was a firm, no-nonsense handshake. Egerton ran his eyes over her, conjured a smile and said, "Let me order some tea, or whatever else you'd like. But do forgive me. I need to slip up to my room. Dump the briefcase and freshen up. I'll rejoin you in a moment. What will you have?" "Tea is fine."
"And scones?"
"No, thanks."
He glanced at his watch.
"Ah, the sun's over the yard arm. I think I'll have a brandy. It's been a long day."
A waiter approached. Egerton placed the order, then added, "And may I also have a glass of water?" The waiter nodded.
"Of course,"
and turned away. Her host took a copy of the Times from under his arm and dropped it in front of her.
"Just started the crossword, and I'm already stuck. Help me out and have a go at it while I'm gone."
He left, moving lightly on his feet. Two things bothered Emma. The first was the man's manner. The second was the fact that she'd managed to see Egerton come down the stairs to the foyer of the dining room because of a large, fortuitously placed mirror. He'd not just come in from outside the hotel at all. She picked up the paper and turned to the crossword. He'd filled in seven words. One of them was wrong. Emma managed to complete well over half the puzzle before Egerton returned. The man glanced briefly at the paper, smiled, and put it down beside his chair. Both the tea and the brandy had arrived, but Egerton did not touch his drink. Instead, he leaned forward and lit the candle in the table's centerpiece with a lighter.
"Let's have some ambiance."
His mercurial mind changed tack again.
"I understand you have just been told that your thesis has been accepted. Congratulations."
"Thank you."
"What will you do now? Will you head home to your parents?"
Emma managed to suppress a shudder, or she thought she had, but Egerton had seen something change in her demeanour, for he said,
"I take it that doesn't appeal. Why's that?"
His question was way too personal, being only just on the right side of rudeness. She glanced up at him, and saw by the set of his jaw that he was not a man to fob off with a polite rebuff.
I don't really know my parents, and they have made it clear that they don't want to have much to do with me. When I was 5 years old, they put me into boarding school here in Oxford, the Dragon School. You may have heard of it." Egerton said nothing. Emma continued.
The thing was, they only lived 10 minutes away.
She shrugged.
I was their only child, and viewed as an inconvenient complication to their social life.
How did that affect you? Emma laughed, but without mirth.
How do you expect? I displayed all the symptoms of an emotionally abandoned child. First, I tried misbehaving to get their attention. Then I tried to be good at everything to try and win their approval, but I never could.
You must have been lonely.
Very. The only saving grace was that they provided me with a nanny. She was Chinese and wonderful. My parents even employed her to care for me when I came back from boarding school on holiday. That's why I developed a fascination with China.
Do you speak Chinese?
I'm moderately good at Cantonese and have a smattering of Mandarin.
Egerton nodded. Go on. Emma shrugged.
There's not much else to say. My parents divorced. Father is now on his third marriage and has sired 5 more children. He lives in London and trades in stocks and shares. Mother is caught in an unhappy second marriage to a lawyer in Exeter.
So yours was not a happy childhood?
It wasn't great, but neither was it all bad. Trying to please my parents turned me into a good student and gave me a love of learning.
What's your relationship with your parents now?
Cordial, but distant. I think they feel a degree of guilt about me. At least my father does. He's given me a generous allowance all the time I've studied here in Oxford.
She shrugged.
I suspect it is conscience money.
Egerton drummed his fingers on the edge of the table. So you have no ties and are free to go anywhere?
I suppose so.
Emma felt it was high time the inquisition into her personal life ended. She elected to take the initiative.
Why are you talking with me, Mr. Egerton? How did you even know of my existence?
I learned of you through Mary Bennet. Emma furrowed her brow.
What? The principal of St. Hilda's College. Why would she speak to you?
Well, she, like you, is a historian. But what you may not know is that she worked for the British Ministry of Information during the Second World War. Emma shook her head in bewilderment.
Just who did you say you worked for, Mr. Egerton? What organization are you with exactly?
Oh, didn't I say?
No, you didn't.
I work for MI5. The hair on the back of her head began to prickle.
Why on earth is MI5 wanting to speak with me?
Because you have an understanding of recent Sino-European history. Emma took a sip of her tea to steady her nerves. Egerton, she noted, had yet to drink his brandy.
And why would that interest you?
Egerton sucked on his lips. It's a delicate time in politics at the moment. Northern Ireland is a mess. Political terrorism is on the rise. And the Soviets have stepped up their activities. He grunted. We've just broken up a large spy ring of theirs. Emma kept her face composed and waited for more. America is withdrawing its troops from Vietnam. Nixon is trying to extricate himself from Watergate, but he's at least managed to score a coup by being the first president to travel to China to visit the chairman of the People's Republic. He glanced up at Emma. As you probably know, China was admitted to the UN last year and is gradually opening up to the West. We need to be ready for it.
And how does that affect me?
Egerton tapped the table with his forefinger. What, in your opinion, is Britain's relationship with China like? Emma replied without hesitation.
Not great. England hasn't acquitted herself well in China's history, and that may come back to bite us. China is an emerging power with huge political ambitions and a massive workforce.
Are we so much on the nose with the Chinese? Emma laughed.
We sent warships to China last century to batter the ships and cities of the Qing dynasty.
Do you know the reason we did this, Mr. Egerton? Opium.
Yes. We wanted to rectify our trade imbalance with China, so we forced them to legalize and then buy the opium we shipped to them from India. When they refused to comply, we rained hell upon them with our gunboats. The Chinese were compelled to open their ports and cede Hong Kong to the British Empire.
Mr. Egerton tilted his head back and sniffed. That was some time ago. Emma folded her hands in her lap.
The indignities inflicted on China did not stop there. Did you know that there are 40 graveyards in northern France and Belgium, holding 10,000 Chinese men?
Egerton said nothing. Emma continued.
They were part of the Chinese Labor Corps.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?